Most world firsts happen only once. It's right there in the word, first. But not the attainment of the North Pole. The North Pole has been reached for the first time at least four times. My name is Peter McGuire, and this is my unlikely explanation. It's worth pointing out up front that what I'm going to talk about here isn't universally agreed upon, especially in general reference material. I think there's enough evidence to say that Cook, Peary, and Bird all lied about reaching the North Pole, but all of them still have supporters today. When I Google who was the first to the North Pole, in big letters at the top it says the answer is Robert Peary, and most of the first 10 articles that come up support either Cook or Peary's claim. Often with the caveat that both were called into question. For my answer, my main source is David Roberts and his excellent book, Great Exploration Hoaxes. It's a fascinating history about a subject that I never thought I would get this into. He's a climber and mountaineer, as well as a former professor of literature, and a well-published author. If you want to know more about the research that he did, he goes into great detail about the original sources and his firsthand knowledge of navigating. My intention with this podcast is to tell this story in a way that is maybe a little more accessible to the layman, and lay out the evidence as clearly and as entertainingly as I can. At the heart of the North Pole controversy lies a logical fallacy that we're all prone to, and that's the either-or fallacy. When we're presented with two options, we usually assume that one is superior to the other, and sometimes don't consider there could be other possibilities. In this case, were presented with two renowned explorers, Cook and Peary. They announced their claims around the same time, and both were squirrely about providing proof. They were rivals, and they worked to discredit each other in newspapers, magazines, geographic society meetings, and even congressional bills. Camps formed around each of them based more on their personal charisma and PR effectiveness than any meaningful proof. When we investigate this question, it's virtually impossible to separate their stories. And yet, there is another possibility. They both could be lying. Consider, there was a lot of prestige tied up in this, and the clock was ticking. They both knew that someone would claim the North Pole as their conquest, and that would happen very soon. In the 20th century, there were very few blanks left on the map. Their name would be attached to one of the last exploration firsts left. And wouldn't that make it all the more terrifying to lie about? These men didn't just feel the weight of history. They were making their journeys specifically to make history. If they got away with it, they'd be a hero to their nation. If they were found out, they'd be remembered as a fraud. And they both wanted desperately to be remembered. So let's meet the first contender. We have Dr. Frederick Cook.
April 21st, 1908, I reached the North Pole and unfurled the stars and stripes.
Cook grew up in poverty. He lost his father at a young age, and you get the sense that he was a loner. He had a lisp that's often remarked on when people from the time write about him. He put himself through medical school, and he opened a private practice in Manhattan. It seems like he would have been happy living that life. But soon after establishing himself, he lost his wife and child in childbirth. Cook needed new meaning, and so he joined Robert Peary's Arctic Expedition of 1891-2 as their surgeon. Which means Cook and Peary actually worked together before their feud, and that's part of what makes the story so great. There are all these little pieces that start to connect. They investigated the northern reaches of Greenland together, both gaining experience with mountaineering and snow trekking, and developing close contacts with the native Greenlanders. But to understand what happened with Cook at the North Pole, we have to look at an earlier world's first first. You see, Cook never would have been believed if he hadn't already established himself as an explorer. In 1906, 2 years before his North Pole claim, Dr. Frederick Cook claimed to have climbed Mount McKinley. Now, Mount McKinley is today called by its original name Denali, and that's probably what you're more familiar with. It's the tallest mountain in North America and the third most isolated peak. It's very remote, then as now. A major difficulty in climbing the mountain is simply getting to it. Cook led an expedition in 1903 where he circumnavigated it, noting which routes might take him to the top, which is no mean feat in and of itself. A journalist on the expedition, Robert Dunn, published an account of the trip, with names changed for decency's sake. In it, he describes his cook stand-in, the professor, as, quote, dumb, with a bovine face. He made desultory decisions, seemed indifferent, and yet his confident, pompous solemnity killed criticism. Not exactly a glowing review. He notes that Cook had a very inexact way of determining his location, which is not a great characteristic in an explorer, and would often refuse to use his navigational instruments at all. This is a major blow to his North Pole claim, for reasons we'll get into later. He returned to McKinley in 1906 with artist and adventurer Belmore Brown and professor Herschel Parker. All three wanted badly to claim the mountain as their conquest. They made observations of the mountain and then returned to the Pacific coast later that year. Against common sense, with winter looming, Cook announced that he would make one last scouting expedition that year, and took with him only Montana blacksmith and horse packer Edward Barrell. A month later, they returned, claiming that they had summited. Brown and Parker were immediately suspicious. They asked Barrell about it, and he told them, quote, I can tell you about the big peak south of the mountain, but if you want to know about Mount McKinley, go and ask Cook. David Roberts writes that you can pinpoint the exact moment in his log when Cook starts to lie. The two men made it to a height of 5,000 feet on the Ruth Glacier, a demanding climb, which leads to a glacial corridor with unforgiving granite cliffs. Suddenly, the narrative shifts from clarity to what Roberts calls melodramatic and vague writing. Facing a difficult route that, still to this day, has probably not been climbed, Cook writes that, quote, rising from ridge to ridge and from cornice to cornice, we finally burst through the gloomy mist onto a bright snowfield. For the next 4 days, they battled the weather and altitude until they reached the summit, where they left a flag in a metal tube to mark their arrival. The return is covered by Cook with just one sentence. Quote, the descent was less difficult, but it took us 4 days to tumble down to our base camp. So we have to ask the question, how do we prove or disprove an explorer? These sorts of expeditions don't really lend themselves to physical evidence. There's nothing identifying you can take from a location. And even if you leave something behind, it can blow away or be hidden by snow long before another explorer can confirm its existence. Lack of evidence doesn't prove or disprove anything in these cases. There are many in the mountaineering community who fully believe in the honor system, that a climber must be taken at his word. But if we do have suspicions, what can we work off of? Well, basically, we have the documents from the journey, the map, descriptions, and celestial or solar observations that are taken along the trek. Ideally, these take the form of the original notebook that went on the journey, and not a second log, because those can be calculated easily after the fact. But Cook actually gave us one better. He took several photographs along the way, and one at the summit. Photography was still a new technology, and many were happy to see the exploration community was taking to it. But taking these photos, it turns out, was one of the biggest mistakes of Cook's life. Reaching the North Pole is different from climbing a mountain, or even from getting to the South Pole. When you climb a mountain, you pretty much find the highest possible point around it, and you stand on it. It's generally easy for mountaineers to agree where the summit of a mountain is. The South Pole is in the middle of Antarctica, which, while it's very cold and remote, has certain advantages being on land. The North Pole is in the middle of a sea, albeit a sea that you can walk on for the most part. But being unmoored from land means that the ice is always moving, which causes several problems. When Peary's Trek was recreated in 2005, they found they were losing 7 miles a day to southerly drift. So they were on a treadmill that was constantly pushing against them. The ice also drifts in a circular motion, which makes it all but impossible to approach the pole in a straight line. The features of this landscape are constantly shifting, so you can't really create useful maps. Frequently cracks open up between the sheets of ice, which create these expanses of open water that explorers either have to retrace their steps to get around, or wait for their sheet to crash back into another one. When the ice sheets do collide, they often crumple up to create these tall walls of ice that can block the way. Cook described the landscape this way.
Nothing very wonderful. Only a shifting desert of frost drifting with the prevailing wind. No life, no land. We were the only pulsating creatures in a dead world of ice.
Even worse, you can't use a compass to find the poles. In 1903, Roald Amundsen discovered the location of the magnetic North Pole, and it was way down around 70 degrees north, on Somerset Island, in Canada, which is nowhere near the 90 degrees of the actual geographic pole. To find the geographic pole, you have to take solar or celestial readings to determine your latitude. Once you reach 90 degrees, you're at the pole. In 1908, this required specialized tools and knowledge, and required you to keep meticulous notes. So how would you get there? Well, the first and most obvious approach would be to sail there. It is in the sea, after all. In 1879, the Jeannette ran into solid ice, traveling north of the Barents Sea, north of Finland. The ship was abandoned after being caught in the ice, but 3 years later, parts of it showed up on the southwest side of Greenland, so the far side from where it was stuck. So, knowing that the ice had this incredible drift, the crew of the Fram intentionally stuck themselves in the ice, and they waited. Eventually, it stopped moving north and started moving south, so that was their cue to abandon the ship and get out on skis. But unfortunately, they had to turn back after about 3 weeks, and were unable to reach the pole by about 4 degrees. The next method would be to fly there, but in the first decade of the 1900s, planes weren't up to the task yet. You could take a balloon, but unfortunately ice accumulation could quickly take it down. So explorers realized that they would need to use the methods that had been developed over millennia by the people who lived in these extreme Arctic conditions, the Inuits, or Somi, or Greenlanders, depending on what area you're talking about. These white explorers learned the necessary skills from these indigenous people, but they would never credit or acknowledge them. They considered them to be their inferiors, despite how much they were learning from them. Now let's meet our other contender, Robert Peary.
The discovery of the North Pole on the 6th of April, 1909, by the last expedition of the Peary Arctic Club, means that the splendid frozen jewel of the North, for which through centuries men of every nation have struggled and suffered and died, is won at last and is to be worn forever by the Stars and Stripes.
Like Cook, Peary lost his father at a young age. He studied civil engineering in Maine and soon found work with the U.S. Navy. After participating in a survey for the proposed Nicaragua Canal, which was later abandoned for one in Panama, he wrote an important paper on methods for crossing Greenland's ice cap. That same year, 1886, he took a leave of absence from the Navy and mounted his first Arctic expedition. 5 years later, he mounted a larger expedition to determine if Greenland's landmass continued up to the North Pole, and this is the expedition where he worked with Cook. On this trip, he honed his methods for leaving caches, building igloos, and wearing furs, and he discovered that Greenland is in fact an island. There would be no land route up to the pole. He launched 2 more expeditions in the following years, and each one set new records for furthest north man had traveled, and set a world record for speed over ice. At that point, he had the techniques, the knowledge, and the experience that he needed to make his great assault on the North Pole. But he also had problems. You see, he was 52 and had lost all but two of his toes to frostbite. He couldn't keep doing these expeditions much longer. The 1908 one was to be his last. This expedition wintered on Ellesmere Island, and he set out for the pole on February 28th of 1909. Along on the journey were Robert Bartlett, a Newfoundlander and expert sledger, and Matthew Henson, who was a son of sharecroppers from Maryland and a rare African-American polar explorer. Here's how Peary describes the expedition.
The expedition, comprising 24 men, 19 sledges, 133 dogs. Four successive supporting parties in command of Macmillan, Borup, Marvin, and Bartlett returned at various intervals, the last in command of Bartlett from the 88th parallel.
The group sledged an average of 9.5 miles a day, but faced many delays, including a 5-day wait at an open lead, which is a span of open water that separates ice sheets. On April 1st, they reached 87 degrees 46 minutes north. At this point, Peary sent the last support party south, choosing for Bartlett to go south while Henson continued with him to the pole. It's unclear why he chose Henson over Bartlett for this final push, but it may have been for precisely the same reason why most people would prefer Bartlett. You see, Bartlett could navigate. Henson could not. According to Peary, it took 5 more days to reach 89 degrees 57 minutes north. In this time, their speed miraculously improved, and their daily distance leapt from 9.5 to 26 miles a day. Peary explains this as the natural consequence of having fewer men tagging along. But even so, that is a huge jump, and if you think that's huge, just wait for the return trip. Even more incredibly, he'd found a nearly straight line to the pole. An analysis in 1973 found that, according to his notes, Peary somehow made a direct beeline to the pole with less than 0.6 degrees of variation. Even ships that are guided by GPS can't do that today because of the drift of the current and the ice. But somehow he achieved this incredible feat without keeping a record of the observations to determine his longitude. And on top of that, the entries for April 6th and 7th in his log are inserted from a different piece of paper. They are not stained with the food and frost that the rest of the log is, meaning that the most crucial calculations would have been the easiest to fake.
Here, in the midst of great fields of heavy ice, covering an ocean 2 miles or more in depth, with the sun circling round the sky day after day without setting, the stars and stripes were planted, and the record left with a piece of the flag.
When asked by Henson if they were at the pole, Peary seemed surprised to find that they were already there. The two shook hands, planted 5 flags, led cheers, and deposited a glass bottle with their records. And then they made their prodigious trip south. Peary claimed that they returned an astounding 133 miles in just 2 days. And this is from the man who had set the world record for speed over an ice pack at 30 miles per day. And yet, he doesn't note this as peculiar. Along the way, Henson notes, Peary suddenly seemed sullen and withdrawn, much to his dismay. Some have suggested that this was because Henson's footprints were already on the spot that Peary had determined to be the true North Pole, that maybe he had been scooped by his own expedition mates. But it's likely that his worries ran deeper than that. You see, Peary could feel the weight of history on the decision that he'd just made.
In the discovery of the North Pole is written the final chapter of the last of the great geographical stories of the Western Hemisphere, which began with the discovery of the New World by Columbus. Here is the cap and climax, the finish, the closing of the book on 400 years of history.
Peary wired news of his attainment of the pole from Labrador on September 6th. The response he got back could not have been worse. Cook had announced, just 5 days earlier, that he had already been to the pole. And even worse, Cook had allegedly been there a year before Peary, in April of 1908. Before Peary had even set out. In contrast to Peary's system of caches and subsidiary parties, Cook's team was minuscule and poorly outfitted.
For this, I selected 2 trustworthy Eskimos as companions, together with 2 sleds, provisions for 80 days, drawn by 26 dogs. We pushed over the leg-breaking irregularities of the polar pack
He apparently reached the pole in the spring of 08 and then survived the following summer on the Arctic Devon Island before returning.
Here we were beset for the winter without food, fuel, or ammunition, with a bow and arrow, the lance, and other primitive methods. We fought the muskox, the bear, and the walrus in an underground den. The long winter nights were spent, and waging a similar warfare, the shores of Greenland were finally reached with a successful record of the polar conquest in April 1909.
It appears to be true that Cook survived north of the Arctic Circle for 14 months, living off the land, which is an incredible feat in and of itself. But he claimed far more than that. He claimed the pole. Both men were asked to produce proof, as you'd expect. Cook's logs were supposedly lost in Greenland because Peary refused to have them transported on his SS Roosevelt. This is consistent with the narrative that you usually see around Cook. He's supposedly well-intentioned and somewhat innocent to the guile of others, and constantly a victim of circumstance. He could only present a typewritten version of his notes, which the University of Copenhagen rejected that December. Soon, the exploration community at large rejected the idea that Cook could have made such a journey without Peary's system of caching. But the mortal blow to his claim would come from an unexpected source. Cook's credibility, his climb of Mount McKinley, came apart due to the work of a couple of his old friends. At first, the photos seemed convincing. After all, he was the first to climb the mountain. There was nothing to compare them to. In his summit photo, he does appear to be at the top of a peak. But in the corner of the summit photo, cropped from some publications of it, is a distant peak. Now, this allows for a technique for finding the exact spot where the photo was taken, by comparing the near and distant mountain features. But even worse, there isn't any peak near to the top of McKinley that would look that large. His two former companions from his McKinley climb, Belmore Brown and Herschel Parker, smelled a rat as soon as Cook returned to civilization. They knew from their own hiking that the climb hadn't taken nearly long enough to complete. Quote, "In the same way that any New Yorker would know that no man can walk from the Brooklyn Bridge to Grant's Tomb in 10 minutes. For years, they harbored quiet suspicions, but did not care to embarrass Cook publicly. They thought they could quietly confront him, but then he disappeared. He returned 2 years later with his story about reaching the North Pole, and Brown and Parker decided it was time. So in 1910, they set out to summit Mount McKinley. They failed in that endeavor, but they did find the spot where Cook's photo was taken. It was an underwhelming outcropping short of one of the hardest stretches of the mountain, right where Cook's narrative changes to that vague wording. In retrospect, you really have to wonder what he was thinking. I mean, he must have known that eventually someone else would reach the top of Denali and discover that his photo didn't match it. Maybe he didn't realize how unforgiving the medium photography could be. At any rate, Brown and Parker published their recreation of the summit photo, and professional opinion rapidly turned on Cook. Cook insisted in many publications that this was a plot by the Peary camp and the National Geographic to discredit him. But at least within the exploration community, his pleas fell on deaf ears. Although he enjoyed a contingent of loyalists, as he still does today, Cook hasn't had widespread support for his claim since those first few months after his announcement. He was acting magnanimous about Peary's own expedition, and Peary was vehemently denouncing him as a liar. The two would continue to slug it out in public forums until Peary's death in 1920, at which point his supporters happily took up his cause. Eventually, Cook's climbing companion Beryl signed an affidavit saying that he and Cook hadn't come close to climbing Mount McKinley. Cook strenuously tried to discredit him in the press, but the jury was already in. And then the Inuits on the North Pole expedition eventually turned on him too. They alleged that they had only traversed a few islands around Nunavut, overwintered, and returned, never going north of land. Cook no longer had the clout to control the narrative. The last word I found on the matter of Cook's North Pole claim was published by Cambridge in 2014. They did a new analysis of his journals and found that he was verifiably behind schedule before he even set out on the ice. There was no chance he could have made it to the pole that winter from his actual locations. He just had too much ground to make up. And yet, the Frederick A. Cook Society maintains to this day an intricate website defending not only his polar expedition, but also the McKinley climb. He himself continued to profess the truth of his claims until he died in 1940, after he was in prison for an unrelated fraud. According to his later contemporaries, his repeated retellings of his conquests became hollow and pathetic. For his part, Peary only shared his records with the National Geographic Society. Yes, that National Geographic. And this is where it gets a little weird, because I tend to think of National Geographic as usually a pretty great and unbiased source. As recently as 2018, they published work in support of the Peary expedition, albeit now they're doing it in a slightly sneaky way. Their latest info gives the first to Matthew Henson, or one of the Inuits on the expedition, which is really just a way of saying that Peary's expedition got there first. Back in 1908, they convened a subcommittee to verify that the navigational information in Peary's logs were true, and they granted him their highest honor. In doing so, their credibility became linked to Peary's. By the way, on this subcommittee, there were three personal friends of Peary's, and the National Geographic had funded the expedition. To this day, they've refused to allow anybody not already friendly with their organization to view the books. Although several researchers have tried to explain the issues with the Peary expedition, none of them have accounted for the incredible jump in speed or the angle of approach. Although the men who recreated it in 2005 came away convinced that it was true. In the public consciousness of the time, as soon as Cook was discredited, Peary emerged the victor by default. And this either-or fallacy still lies at the heart of the question. The majority of articles I can find note that both men's claims had problems, but almost all are written with a clear preference for one or the other. Great Exploration Hoaxes is one of the very few sources that I can find that unequivocally states neither man made it to the pole. And it also makes a couple of other interesting observations about hoaxers. You see, these hoaxes are typically carried out by men who have suffered loss, and they see exploration as the only way to distinguish themselves. They start to see whatever they're attempting as an all-or-nothing proposition. Failure becomes unthinkable. Usually most of the journey is attempted earnestly, and then, in a spur of the moment, when they realize that it can't be done, the decision to lie is made. At this point, things that were clear and specific in their logs become opaque and vague. The original sources become unavailable, the companions become enemies, and any hint of suspicion becomes heresy. So if it wasn't Cook, and it wasn't Peary, who did reach the North Pole first? The next generally accepted claim belongs to Admiral Richard Byrd, the famous airman and darling of the National Geographic Society. You can imagine where this is going. It's generally accepted that he flew over the North Pole in May of 1926, just barely beating out Roald Amundsen's dirigible flight a few days later. This flight made him an American hero and set him on a long career of distinguished flights and explorations. But it's likely that Admiral Richard Byrd never flew over the North Pole.
Our very distinguished guest for this evening is Admiral Richard E. Byrd.
I must say that Admiral Byrd, our guest tonight, is not only our greatest living explorer, but he's been an inspiration to countless Americans. Admiral Byrd, you've been to both the North Pole and the South Pole. Is there any unexplored land left on this earth?
Unlike Peary, Byrd's expedition was at the beginning of his career, at least in the public eye. He grew up well off, in a preeminent family in Virginia, and spurred by his small stature, he turned to sports to distinguish himself. At age 23, he shattered his right foot doing gymnastics, and the next year he slipped aboard ship and he broke it again. He graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy and became an ensign, but after just 4 years of service, he was medically retired for that foot injury. He went on to Capitol Hill, where he became a lobbyist working to champion aviation. By age 28, he had a distinguished career, but it had fallen far short of his own expectations. On May 6, 1926, he and Navy Chief Aviation Pilot Floyd Bennett left from Spitsbergen, north of Norway, and returned 15 hours and 27 minutes later, claiming to have flown over the North Pole. It's worth noting that Bennett was the pilot and Byrd was the navigator. Byrd was immediately thrust into the public eye and became a national hero. As with Peary 17 years before, the National Geographic Society convened a subcommittee, and 5 days later, they affirmed that Byrd's account was correct in every particular. He was given the key to New York City, enjoyed a ticker tape parade down Broadway, and received from President Coolidge the Hubbard Gold Medal, which is the National Geographic Society's honor for great explorers. He joined its earlier recipients, Robert Peary and Roald Amundsen. With the time and resources afforded by his newfound celebrity, he turned his attention towards completing a transatlantic flight. In May of 1927, Charles Lindbergh beat him to the punch, but at the end of the following month, Byrd matched this feat with a three-man crew. Again, Byrd was not the pilot, but in this case, he received the Distinguished Flying Cross. Then, in 1928, he set up a base on the Ross Ice Shelf in Antarctica, which he called Little America. From here, he flew his plane, the Floyd Bennett, which he named after his old pilot and friend who had died of pneumonia the previous year, over the South Pole, becoming the first man to have flown over both poles. He was promoted to the rank of Rear Admiral by a special act of Congress that December, which made him the youngest admiral in the history of the United States Navy. He was present at the Japanese surrender in Tokyo Bay in 1945. He later established Little America as the first permanent military base on Antarctica. He died of a heart ailment in his sleep at age 68. It was a distinguished life in the public eye, a life to be very proud of. And it all started with that flight over the North Pole. And yet, as with Peary, there's a little bit more to this story. You see, Byrd had competition, and it was serious competition. When he arrived in Spitsbergen, there was already an explorer there attempting a flyover of the North Pole. And unfortunately for Byrd, this was the preeminent polar explorer of the age. This was Roald Amundsen, and he had been preparing to fly over the North Pole in a dirigible called the Norge. A dirigible is a semi-rigid balloon, so it's like a zeppelin or an airship or kind of similar to a blimp. Roald Amundsen was more than well-suited to the task. He had come from a maritime family in Norway and had attended school to be a doctor at his mother's urging and quit as soon as she died when he was 21. At that point, he followed his first love, the sea. He was part of the Belgian Antarctic Expedition as first mate, which was the first expedition to overwinter in Antarctica. And he noted that the crew would likely have died of scurvy, if not for the hunting skills of their American doctor, anthropologist, and photographer, a certain Dr. Frederick Cook. In 1903, Amundsen led the first expedition to traverse Canada's Northwest Passage. As of 2007, this is considered an open passage due to the melting of polar ice, but in 1903, this was considered an impossible route. Amundsen finally proved that a skillful crew could make it through without getting stuck in the ice. For that, he was awarded the National Geographic Society's Hubbard Medal. In 1909, he got word that Cook or Peary had been the first to reach the North Pole, so he set his sights on the South Pole. And for a number of complex reasons that I will untangle in another episode, by 1912, Amundsen returned home successful, a national hero, and Robert F. Scott, his British rival, had frozen to death on Antarctica. For the next several years, Amundsen worked towards finding a northeastern passage, north of Russia, and then he set his sights again on the North Pole. First, he tried using the natural rotation of the sea ice to carry a ship over the North Pole, as in the Fram attempt, and actually he borrowed the same ship, the Fram, and went bankrupt in the process. He then turned to airplanes, and across two harrowing flights that he was lucky to survive, Amundsen determined that no plane could reach the North Pole on one tank of fuel and survive the harsh conditions. In order to be sturdy enough to survive the flight, it had to be too heavy to make the distance. So, he hit on another idea, the dirigible. This seemed like the best of both worlds, because he could carry more weight and could drift without spending fuel when the wind was right. and then Byrd steamed into port. He had made his own tests in his trimotor Fokker and had determined that by dropping 300 gallons of fuel and taking off at midnight when the snow would be hard, he could just make it to the pole. Although it's unclear why Byrd thought that an airplane could make this distance when Amundsen did not. We do know that Byrd kept his calculations private. On May 9th, at 12:37, 2 days before Amundsen was able to launch his dirigible, Byrd took off in his plane, the Josephine Ford. Byrd navigated while Floyd Bennett piloted. At 4:07 p.m., they touched down. It had only been 15 hours and 37 minutes, and the right engine was leaking oil. Before he left, Byrd told a Norwegian journalist that he expected the flight to last 20 hours. Some have tried to explain away the fast flight time with a polar cyclone that would have provided a tailwind both on the way out and on the way back. Byrd wrote that when they reached the pole, the wind began to freshen and change direction. However, weather data from that day suggested they were flying in a virtually no-wind atmosphere. And then there's the issue of the leaking engine. Any sane pilot would have turned around as soon as they noticed that malfunction. Byrd reported that they had noticed it right over the pole, which seems awfully convenient. Could it be that they did turn around as soon as the malfunction began? Then Berndt Balkan published his autobiography, Come North With Me, in 1958. Balkan had assisted in getting the plane ready for the North Pole flight. He went on the national tour with Byrd that followed, and he eventually became his main pilot after Floyd Bennett's early death. He was the chief pilot on the transatlantic flight and the flight over the South Pole. His friend Dickie Byrd, as Admiral Byrd was affectionately called, had died the previous year, which emboldened him to share what he knew. He relayed that on flights that he piloted, Byrd hadn't taken a single sextant reading, which meant that the South Pole flight couldn't even be verified. He also wrote that Byrd liked to drink cognac in flight, and after one flight had to be carried to his bunk, he was so insensible from drink. He also wrote about the North Pole flight. He had been making calculations on mileage and fuel consumption, which are crucial metrics when you're trying to fly with just enough fuel. Byrd told him with, quote, eyes full of cold fire, forget about that slide rule. From now on, you stick to flying, I'll do the figuring. According to Balkan's calculations, based on their tests, Byrd and Bennett couldn't have gotten closer to the pole than 88 degrees, 15 minutes, and 30 seconds. Furthermore, Floyd Bennett had confided in him near the end of his life that he didn't believe that he or Byrd had flown over the North Pole. Then there's Byrd's data itself. Henry Rollins is a researcher who made his name from debunking the Peary expedition in 1973. In 1996, he wrote a book about his attempts to verify Byrd's North Pole flight. He found that the National Geographic study of Byrd's data took place from June 23rd to the 28th. And yet, Byrd had been given the Hubbard Medal on the 23rd. So the study had happened after the medal was awarded, if it happened at all. He also found a letter from Byrd to the American Geographic Society, which is a different body from National Geographic, apologizing for the delay in supplying his navigational records, because he had not yet, quote, mathematically worked them out. But what was there to work out? He would have needed to work out these figures in flight to figure out where the North Pole was. His private papers remain in the custody of his family in Boston, and even Byrd's biographer was not given access when he went to write his official biography. Biographies written by his contemporaries in Antarctica reveal a man obsessed with secrecy and loyalty. He would take crew members off on long walks to question them about their loyalty, and insist that they report any sign of disloyalty in others directly to him. Despite his cheery public persona, most people who worked with him found him to be standoffish and intentionally opaque. What was the purpose for this secrecy? Could this have been the result of a lifetime of maintaining a guilty conscience? Or maybe general insecurity about his place in America's pantheon of explorers? One of Byrd's Antarctic pilots wrote of him, quote, he did not fly, he was flown, he did no navigating at all on any of my flights with him, nor, according to Balkan, did he do any on his transatlantic flight. So what did Byrd do? Well, it appears that he courted the press well, and he cultivated powerful friendships. The plane he flew north, the Josephine Ford, was named for the daughter of his benefactor, the president of the Ford Corporation. He kept connections from his D.C. days, and he delivered what the country wanted most, which was prestige. I'll give the final word on this matter to Byrd, albeit via hearsay. Rollins found a letter from another of Byrd's Antarctic pilots, and in it he discusses a conversation he had with the then president of the American Geographic Society. He had confided in him, quote, "I managed to break down Dickie Byrd," and he confessed that he had not reached the North Pole, but had missed it by about 150 miles. If this is true, then Byrd did something that Cook and Peary did not. He admitted his hoax, however privately. Which brings us back to our original question. If not Cook, if not Peary, if not Byrd, who was the first person to reach the North Pole? We must give that honor to Amundsen, who flew over it in his dirigible, the Norge, on May 12th of 1926 at 1:25 a.m., 3 days after Byrd had stolen his glory. They made a small circle to ensure they had passed over the pole and landed on the far side of the world in Point Barrow, Alaska. This made Amundsen the first person to have been to both poles. 2 years later, he went out of this world in a remarkably heroic and fitting way. He flew north to rescue a group of Italians, men who had helped on his Norge flight, who had crashed their own dirigible in the Arctic. He flew north, and he never returned. His plane has yet to be found. He's almost certainly still in that plane, somewhere at the bottom of the Arctic Sea. He died without knowing that he had achieved what Cook, Peary, and Byrd could not. But I hear you, Peary, saying, well, flying over it doesn't really count. That's a matter of opinion, but I'll offer you a few options. The first people to stand at the pole were Soviet scientists who landed near it in 1948 and set up a camp to conduct experiments. In 1959, the USS Skate, an American submarine, surfaced at the pole, breaking through the ice above it, so they were on the surface of the Earth at the pole, and they were the first to reach it by water. The first undisputed attainment by land was that of Ralph Plainsted and his crew of three who traveled there by snowmobile in 1968. Yeah, that's right. Because of Cook and Peary, the first land attainment probably happened 6 decades later than we thought. The following year, in 1969, Wally Herbert and his crew were the first to reach the pole by unpowered travel. They used only their feet and dog sleds, although they were aided by airdrops of supplies. So you're welcome to take your pick as to which of those is the realest attainment. Now you know the shockingly complex answer to the question, who was the first to reach the North Pole? It makes you wonder what other world firsts are shrouded in politics and nationalism, and it makes you think about how fragile our knowledge of the past is. Bodies like the National Geographic build their reputations on the reflected light of their champions. When explorers lie, it's not just their reputation at stake, but a whole network of reputations and societies and personal fortunes. Even a century later, there are political and professional reasons not to confront the truth. But everyone, even respected explorers, have the capacity to lie. It appears that these lies took a toll on the people who perpetrated them. David Roberts writes that, quote, "Theirs is a silent conspiracy against the world. The hoax became the central fact of their existence. The world was reduced to allies and betrayers." And he's right, this is a very personal form of lying, and it uncovers manipulative and paranoid tendencies in the men who must day after day reconfirm their lie, constantly confronted by opportunities to come clean, but trapped by the enormity of the consequences. Furthermore, these deceits rely on an imbalance of power. We see this in how Cook treated Beryl, how Peary treated Henson, how they both treated their Inuit companions, and how Byrd treated Bennett. The only people allowed to have first-hand knowledge of the hoax must be of lower social standing, so they can be denigrated and discredited. Even from their unwitting co-conspirators, the hoaxer must isolate. For this podcast, we went in search of the North Pole, but instead we found cold, dark places in the hearts of three men who could not admit the truth. I'm Peter McGuire, and this has been my unlikely explanation. ¶¶
I've heard it said that there are 7 continents in the world, and one of them has never been seen by a woman, and that's Antarctica. Is that actually true?
Well, if the Palm Peninsula is an island, as far as I know, that's true. No woman's ever stepped foot upon the Antarctic continent, and it's the most peaceful place in the world.
Well, I'm sure that won't last very long.